Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California will soon have a three-digit hotline number specifically for those experiencing a mental health crisis. The hotline will serve as an alternative to 911. However, funding the new mental health crisis line was a main hurdle lawmakers faced. Last week, the state announced they would fund the new program with $20 million, but that falls short of the $50 million advocates believe is required to support the call centers. Here to help us better understand how the 988 hotline will work and why funding has been a hurdle is CalMatters health reporter Jocelyn Wiener. Jocelyn, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to the 988 hotline, how did this all originate?
I think this is something that people have wanted to see for years, an alternative to 911, because so often people who have a loved one in a mental health crisis end up calling 911, and that ends up escalating to very unintended situations. And then last year, the federal government passed a law saying that 988 would become an alternative number starting this coming July, but has left it to the states to figure out how to fund the call centers.
Now, from my understanding, this is in tandem with already existing infrastructure, like with the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, correct?
Yeah, so those call centers, there are 13 of them in California, would be the ones that are fielding the calls, but that it would build connections between those call centers and 911. So if someone calls one and is really more appropriate for the other, they'd be able to transfer them. And then the other part of it is really trying to come up with funding to build out mobile crisis response. So not just that you have somewhere to call, but that if there's an emergency, people who are trained mental health professionals can respond instead of the police.
Were you able to gauge the volume of calls centers have already been receiving? Has it been increasing in recent years?
Yeah, they say it's been increasing, I think they said 67% in recent years, and then with the pandemic had increased further. So they've already seen an increase, but they're predicting something like a tripling of call volume once there's like a publicity campaign and more people know about 988. It's officially rolling out next July.
Wow. That's a significant increase or a significant projection at this point. And I think what I'm hearing is that the conversation surrounding mental health has been evolving, but now it seems like at least in the last year and now with states such as California, there's now a political will to invest in it.
Yeah. I mean, on the flip side there, there's also a bill that has really struggled. Every state has had the ability to basically put a fee on phone lines to fund 988. Like that's part of the federal laws that states can pass this legislation, but states have really struggled on that end. A couple states have managed to pass it, but so far in California, it's been stalled.
Yeah, I think we forget that we also, pay for 911 as well when we have a phone line. When there's pushback, where is that pushback coming from? And I guess really, what fees are we talking about?
Pushback, I think largely nationally, has been coming from the telecommunications industry, who want to see this be paid for through general fund money, or they're willing, at least in California, they say that they're willing to have like the infrastructure that specifically relates to answering the calls, the 988 calls, be funded with a fee, but that they want that to be very limited, because what advocates want to see is that there be enough of a fee that it could also cover things like mobile crisis response. And the bill was going to cap it at 80 cents per line per month. The telecommunications industry said they were wanting to see more like a cap of 10 cents per line per month. And I don't think that they would necessarily go to 80 cents per month, but it would depend sort of on the projections of how much it was going to cost each year. And the other thing that's important to note is that these would be ongoing costs. So while the state has come up with $20 million to kind of help with startup costs, that isn't going to fund this ongoing.
When it comes to how this will actually work next July, I believe is what you said, how will this be different from a 911 call?
Well, if you or a family member are having an emergency, you call 988 instead of call 911, and that routes you to these call centers where there will be people who will be, I think, able to triage and figure out what's going on. Is it just that the person needs someone to talk with, or do they need some sort of intervention? And is that intervention something that would be best provided by a mental health professional? I mean, if it's not, if there's like, I think, a real serious concern that there's safety, then I guess police can be brought in. That's part of it, is that, and I think similarly, people calling 911 could be routed to 988 if that's more appropriate.
And I think this also comes just as years, you know, some have advocated to not have police show up during a mental health emergency. There have been instances of a person being shot by police during a mental health crisis. I mean, there are multiple instances that we can just go back on recent reports here in Northern California. So how will this program change that dynamic? And were you able to talk to any of those families where that happened to them and a loved one?
Yeah, I talked to a couple different families who've lost loved ones in with serious mental illness after they or someone else called police. And I think that they feel it's really important, especially once you're also able to build out some of the response so that it's not just that you have a place to call, but that there's also someone who can come. Because I know that, I mean, for some of these families, like, they made a call because they were worried about their loved one, and then the worst possible thing happened, and like, they watched their son or brother be killed in front of them, and then to have to live with that question, should I have called, is, I think, just really agonizing. And so they feel really strongly that there needs to be an alternative.
I mean, the whole goal when dialing 988 is to have someone respond to the scene, and also to have the staffing available to handle the influx of calls if they're projecting to increase threefold. So are there concerns that, you know, the infrastructure might not be there to actually handle the demand when this rolls out?
I mean, that was definitely what the concerns that people were voicing to me while I was reporting the story. Now, since that time, they did come up with $20 million, which I know will help. But I think, you know, there's still going to be a concerted effort to get more funding and also to get a bill passed that will allow for these fees to sort of fund this program ongoing.
Yeah, and you mentioned $20 million, but I guess initially they had wanted $50 million, so that's less than half. Is there the possibility that someone calling 988 could be put on hold while they're going through a crisis?
I mean, that is what they have voiced as a concern. I think that at the same time, they're doing everything they can to make sure that doesn't happen. And so, you know, there are other efforts underway, I think, in addition to what's going on at the state. I know they're sort of trying to turn over every rock to make sure that they can have the funding, because they really don't want to see that happen.
Is this already happening in other states?
988, you mean?
Yes, yeah.
So it's all supposed to be rolling out federally next July. So there, I think different states are in different places in terms of securing the funding and getting things up and running. But, you know, California also has, you know, I think has some more crisis infrastructure than some states. So we're definitely not the worst off here.
Well, Jocelyn, thanks so much for spending some time with us and sharing your reporting.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is CalMatters health reporter, Jocelyn Weiner. And up next, we're going to dive into the impact of cannabis cultivation and what it's having on the state's watershed. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. 5 years after voters approved adult-use recreational marijuana, the industry is growing, but there are still struggles within the legal cannabis industry. In 2020, sales in California hit a record $4.4 billion. That's a more than 50% increase in sales when compared to 2019. However, the legal cannabis industry is criticized also for being costly and complicated. And despite legalization, there's still stiff competition from illegal grows. The impacts of illegal or non-compliant grows are far-reaching. Today, we're going to focus on the environmental impacts on the watershed. The South Yuba River Citizens League is a nonprofit in Nevada County, home to a prevalent cannabis cultivation industry. But this foothill community is also home to the watershed surrounding the South Yuba River. The nonprofit recently surveyed the cannabis industry in their county to better understand why growers are not in compliance, the challenges of navigating the system, and ultimately the growing industry's environmental impact on their beloved watershed. Betsy Bruner with the South Yuba River Citizens League, that's also known as CIRCLE for short, joins us now with what they learned from their community survey. Welcome to Insight, Betsy.
Thanks for having us on, Vicki.
You know, what is the culture surrounding cannabis in Nevada County? Because it goes back beyond 2016, correct?
Oh, definitely. The cannabis culture in Nevada County definitely goes back decades, well before the official legalization of it. And it's been a part of at least certain subcultures and across the county, since then.
What are the benefits of the cannabis industry?
Well, some cannabis cultivators really focus on cultivation that they find creates an even better environment than when they found it. So engaging in best management practices, companion planting, really working to create healthier soils and so forth, so that they are not only creating or cultivating cannabis for medicinal purposes and other purposes, recreational purposes, but also making sure that they're giving back to the watershed and creating healthier soils.
What sparked the survey?
So what sparked the survey is that in 2019, Nevada County passed an emergency or adopted an urgency ordinance that was really intended to encourage compliance, because we were finding that reports of negative environmental impacts. And so this urgency ordinance was adopted. Hopefully it was intended to encourage compliance, but only 3% of the estimated 3,500 cultivators in Nevada County have actually achieved compliance. So some of the questions were, why aren't people working toward compliance? Why aren't they engaging in the process? And also, what impacts is it having on the greater community, the community writ large? Because as cultivation practices expand, people are finding changes to, for example, their neighborhood and everything, and reports of dumping and diversions and clear cutting and so forth.
3% of an estimated 3,500 cultivators, was that surprising to you?
Yes and no. On one hand, it has only been a little over a year. But on the other hand, we were definitely hoping for much, much higher compliance rates But the other issue is that the process of coming into compliance is people find to be overwhelming and complicated and expensive. And so those are some of the reasons that are deterring people from coming into compliance.
You know, if there are those hurdles and it's a complicated and costly process, I guess from that survey, were you able to actually find some solutions to help them navigate that process and get them into compliance?
Well, some of it needs, what people are really asking for is the streamlining of the process and assistance with the process. So yes, it's going to be complicated. CEQA is complicated. Going through that is complicated. And there's not a lot we can do to change that, but we can provide support for people to navigate that process. And we can simplify all the other parts of the process. And people just felt that it was so complicated and so overwhelming. And then an additional sector of people also were not trust, they didn't trust official or government entities. And so that was a barrier to them wanting to come into compliance as well, like handing over all that information, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, we started off this conversation, you know, saying that the cannabis culture has been, you know, in Nevada County for decades. But how has legalization influenced the community and the culture of longtime residents in your area?
Yeah, a lot of changes have occurred. So I think the actual area itself and the climate and it's really great. It's a really great place to cultivate cannabis. Has expanded the cannabis industry. So I think the legalization of recreational use has expanded the cannabis industry. So while it used to be that people would grow it as a hobby, now people are growing it as a profession. And so it's changed the community in a number of ways. One in particular being that, you know, decades ago, like I said, when it was a hobby, that meant that people had other jobs. So I may be a daytime school teacher, or I may be a plumber, or I may be an insert job, but I do this cultivation on the side. So when people move towards larger and larger scale cultivation, it homogenizes the workforce, or, you know, limits kind of what people are in different jobs, and then people become primarily cultivators, because if you can make $1,000 to $2,000 per plant, that's a lot better than the $35,000 I'm making a year doing, you know, another job. So it has changed in that way. And then it's also the expansion of it has really changed the feel of neighborhoods. So respondents to this survey, for example, complained about high fences, increased traffic, barking dogs, smell, and so forth. And so it changes like neighborhood culture, where you know everybody that lives next to you, to now all of a sudden there's this privacy wall, and it's very intimidating. And I see people coming and going, and I don't know any of them.
You know, and I think it's just important to remind, you know, listeners that Circle is a nonprofit that focuses on the environment, you know, surrounding the South Yuba River. So what have you learned in terms of the impact that cannabis cultivation as it expands is posing to the watershed in your area?
Some of the major impacts that it's posing are illegal water diversions, which is incredibly important in times of drought, which California is experiencing now and has gone through mass droughts in the past. So as soon as you divert water, you're increasing water temperatures downstream, decreasing flows, and making it difficult for anything that calls that river home or the banks next to it to survive. So increased water temperatures means less oxygen in the water for fish and so forth. It also means that any kind of dumping, which also occurs, like pesticide or pesticide runoff, is going into a much smaller amount of water, which means the impacts are greater. And then another major concern that we're seeing is when people are not up to code and create fire hazards, it can create forest fires in an area that is in extreme fire danger.
Yeah.
And we've seen that happen as well.
You know, following this survey, I guess, where do you want this survey to go? What other stakeholders and who are you talking with and sharing this survey with to actually, you know, get some solutions?
Sure. Well, we've shared the results with the county. We've also shared the results with the Nevada County Cannabis Alliance. And we also made the results available to the public. The survey, really what we wanted to do is take, it wasn't particularly surprising in some ways. People expected a lot of the results, but what we did was turn anecdotal evidence into numbers and data that can be used when revising this compliance process. So we would love to help in any way educate more cultivators about the importance of coming into compliance and also encourage it and hopefully encourage support for cultivators to navigate the process and any kind of simplification and relieving financial burden possible, I think would be great ways.
Well, before we let you go, I believe your river cleanup is this weekend. You want to share any details about that? I love the South Yuba River. It's such a gorgeous part of Nevada County.
Well, thank you. Yes, we do have our 24th annual Yuba River cleanup. It starts this Saturday and is taking place for 8 days. So you can get involved in a self-guided cleanup where you call us up, you find a site, or we give you a site, or we work with you to find a site, and you and your family, your friends, or your coworkers go out and clean up a particular site. We'll take the trash from you when you're done. Or you can join us the 18th, Saturday the 18th, for the community-wide cleanup, where we have site leaders positioned all around the watershed to clean up places. So we're definitely looking for more volunteers, and it's a great way to clean up after a heavy use season. People come into the river and sometimes accidentally leaving behind some trash.
Betsy, thanks for spending time with us and sharing the survey.
Thank you.
Betsy Bruner is with the South Yuba River Citizens League, also known as CIRCLE, and she is sharing what they've learned with the cannabis cultivation industry in Nevada County and its environmental impact on the watershed. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. So we're going to give you a quick bullet point recap. So voters approved legalized possession, cultivation, and use of recreational marijuana in 2016, and then voters then expanded that to include sale and taxation in 2018. So when that happened, a portion of those taxes went to the creation of a new enforcement branch within California State Parks, the Cannabis Watershed Protection Program, launched in 2019 with a focus on illegal cannabis cultivation within state parks, which damages resources in watersheds across California. Catherine Caldwell and Jeremy Stinson join us with the California State Parks Cannabis Watershed Protection Program. Welcome, Catherine and Jeremy.
Thank you. Good morning.
And also,
good morning.
And also joining us is Janice Mackey with California Fish and Wildlife, because the two agencies work closely together on cannabis cultivation enforcement. Welcome, Janice.
Welcome, and thank you for having me.
Happy you're here. Well, Catherine, starting with you, in the 2 years since this program launched, or almost 2 years, what have you learned about illegal cannabis cultivation within state parks across the state?
It's been really interesting. And as Betsy already described, illegal cannabis cultivation is not new. State parks has had problems with trespass or illegal grows for decades. And, you know, a number of our parks are up in the Emerald Triangle, so to speak, which is really kind of a ground zero for cannabis cultivation in this state and in the country. So with the establishment of the Cannabis Watershed Protection Program, we've been able to develop a really amazing program that includes disciplines from throughout the state park system. We have archaeologists, natural resource managers, road and trail experts, as well as obviously our expert law enforcement, who are very well versed in dealing with the unique hazards that are associated with these kinds of grows. We have had grows reported all the way from our parks near the Oregon border down to the Mexican border across the Colorado desert. So With this new program centralizing the data collection, you know, we have 21 administrative districts, so now we're able to collect all of that data in one location and really be able to discern where our hotspots are and focus the resources necessary to identify these growths more quickly and respond to them and reduce damage associated, and then start to predict where those growths might be and do more prevention.
Jeremy, when discussing illegal and trespass cannabis cultivation and the problem across the state, is this a few and far between problem when we're talking about state parks, or is this more widespread than we might think?
I think it's safe to say this is more widespread than most people realize. Not to be alarmist by any means, but we do have a substantial, well-documented history of cannabis cultivation within our state parks. And as Catherine described, we've seen grows from the Mexican border at Anza Borrego Desert State Park all the way up north to Humboldt Redwoods. The reality is we have beautiful state parks, but they're also very well-suited for cannabis cultivation.
Given that the both of you see this firsthand, are there common threads between each grow that you encounter?
So, you know, the common thread is that, unfortunately, most of these grows that are occurring in state parks are not smaller mom and pop type operations. These are grows that we routinely find that have 5, 10, even 20,000 plants growing in them. And these larger grows are typically run by drug trafficking organizations. But other than that, the other common thread is, and one of the reasons why this program is so important, is the environmental impact that we find at all these grow sites. And that ranges from water diversion to the introduction of very dangerous pesticides and rodenticides that the growers use to keep wildlife out of their crop.
Janice, what role does California Fish and Wildlife play in all of this?
Well, gosh, Fish and Wildlife have a very important role with legal and illegal cannabis cultivation. On the legal side, when you go to apply to get a state license, the first step you got to do is check in with Fish and Wildlife and notify us of your proposed activities. So if you're applying to get a state license, we want to know where you're going to grow, how many plants, and most importantly, where your water source is coming from. And depending on the circumstances, will either issue you a lake and stream bed alteration agreement or verification one is not needed. And this is all in an effort to reduce environmental impacts so folks can cultivate responsibly. And on the illegal side, we have a long history of cannabis enforcement against illegal grow on public lands, starting back to the 80s. And where we were assisting the California Department of Justice in combating illegal grows in national forests, state parks, all over the state. And so we have a pretty long history. And in 2013, we developed our first marijuana enforcement team. Before that, we were using district wardens, depending on the resources available to combat illegal cultivation. In 2013, we got the marijuana enforcement team, consisting of 8 to 10 wildlife officers who have training and specialty in combating illegal grows on public lands, where some of the state's worst environmental violations have occurred. And this unique team goes out and, does investigations, researches, and, ultimately confronts people at these illegal sites cultivating. And they are very dangerous places. Most every time we go out there, there are armed individuals guarding the plants. They are poisoning, poaching wildlife, water diversions, pesticide use, all sorts of terrible things for the environment.
You're going.
And so we kind of play both sides of the equation.
Well, going to the first part of what you were talking about, so cannabis cultivation in some instances can be allowed on public lands?
Never allowed on public lands. Cannabis cultivation is only allowed on private property. Cannabis cultivation on public lands is never allowed. So we do cannabis enforcement of illegal cultivation on public and private lands. And then we also help with the permitting process on private lands for people that really want to run a legitimate business. We do as much as we can to help them get through it. They can call, email us. We host cannabis permitting workshops with the state water boards, the Department of Cannabis Control, the Agriculture Labor Relations Board. We have a grant program to assist cultivators that may be facing financial barriers on the road to compliance. We're hosting our first technical assistant program for cultivators in Humboldt County in a few weeks. So we're doing as much as we can to help people in the regulated market get into it and be compliant.
One of the most recent examples that I came across was about a little over a week ago, State Parks discovered a grow at Sonoma Coast State Park that's near Bodega Bay. And, you know, I guess we're talking about like over 1,500 plants and more than 1,000 pounds of trash. I saw some of the images, but Catherine, can you just kind of help us picture what did this look like? And was this in a nondescript location?
Well, That's a great question, because I don't want folks to get the impression that it's hazardous to visit state parks, because the reality is, as Janice says, there's a lot of cultivation that goes on public lands, and that's federal lands, national park, Forest Service lands, fish and wildlife lands, as well as state park lands and others. And these growers make a very concerted effort to be very, very difficult to find. These things can be like finding a needle in a haystack. And so in this case, the grow was off of a very narrow country lane, a single lane road that was very low neighborhood traffic, very rural area, in a park that didn't have a lot of public access. You know, this is a place where your usual day use visitor coming to visit Sonoma Coast State Beach is not going to go. It's kind of more of a backcountry area. And so the grow site is well off of established trails, very remote, rugged area, in a wooded area where a lot of trees were cleared. The terraces can be in multiple layers, so very steep access between the different, it's almost like rice paddies at different levels. Absolutely no vegetation within the plot itself. I mean, it's strange that like there's no leaves. You know, you think you're in the middle of a forest and there's no leaves. It's just absolutely bare soil. Very large pits that are dug. And this is very typical. They're making basically little mini dams and holding water back in those dams that they're using to irrigate the sites. Huge pits for trash. And this, all of this alteration of the surface contributes to huge impacts, environmental impacts. And so we've talked about a number of those. And one that often gets overlooked is the potential impact to cultural resources, because anytime you dig a hole to plant a plant, let alone a huge cistern for water or trash, you have the potential to disturb archaeological artifacts, and that increases the risk of looting. And like I mentioned, we have archaeologists on our team, and it turns out they're very, very good at helping us identify the larger footprint of these grows, because they're good at identifying human impacts on land. A lot of times when growers can find these sites that are off the beaten path, that are not easily located, they reoccupy those sites year after year. And so the impacts can be cumulative. And that's why it's so important that we get out there early and get all of that trash removed and the irrigation material removed to reduce the risk of reoccupation.
I mean, you're talking about a needle in a haystack, public lands and, you know, state parks, national forests, county park. I mean, they're so widespread and vast mm-hmm. across the state. How did you find that needle?
That's Jeremy's story. Yeah.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So we... as Catherine described, we have a team of peace officers who are solely focused on finding and entering these very hard to find cannabis cultivation sites. We have a few different tools at our disposal. We can use overflights and see some of these sites from the air. In this particular case, we had a couple of documented grow sites, not in the exact same location, but nearby. So that area was kind of on our radar as a potential site that we needed to patrol. And that's how we found it.
We're also talking about water being diverted. Betsy also brought this up in Nevada County. We actually received an email from a listener in Mendocino County, and they were talking about illegal cannabis grows sucking water out of their streams, rivers, and groundwater, leaving some community members' wells dry. Have you come across this?
If you're on the permitted side, there's a forbearance period of taking water, diverting water from streams. If you're a permitted cultivator, you're not supposed to take water from March 15th to November 15th. You're allowed to divert water and store it during the rainy seasons. As far as water being taken from ground wells and stuff like that, I haven't received any information on that. But, you know, given that water is so scarce up there, that could be an issue. We're in a major drought. Water is scarce. Mendocino and Sonoma counties are very hard hit. So that could be a reality. But as far as diverting surface waters, there is a forbearance period. And those folks that would do that during the non-forbearance period, could face a notice of violations and so forth. And that can be very serious.
Yeah, Janice, we're talking also just about hazardous material. How does all of this get cleaned up?
Well, it depends on where the illegal grow is. If it's on public lands, Fish and Wildlife, and we will step in and help clean it up. At these illegal grow sites, you find huge amount of trash, camping equipment, generators, stoves, rodenticides, pesticides, fertilizer bags. It amazes me how they get those materials into these clandestine locations. And what we do is I've gone to several grow cleanups on public lands. We gather all the materials, we put it in a central location, we put it on a tarp, and they are airlifted out. They get a helicopter, they lower a big rope with a hook, and they hook up we tie the tarp up, and they airlift it out of there. One of the most amazing things to see is when we're airlifting the polypipe out of there, because it's miles and miles of black polypipe being airlifted and cleaned up. They're all over the place, like big spider webs on the ground, like miles and miles of it to use as drip lines. If an illegal grow is on private property, it's up to the landowner or occupant to clean it up. Enforcement will go in there and eradicate the plants. And I have to say, enforcement on private property is largely coordinated with local authorities, the county sheriff, city police, county code enforcement. And it's also environmental scientists will go in after the site is secured and look for any and all environmental violations. And so they'll document water diversions, trash in and around waterways, illegal pesticide use, stuff like that. So on public lands, there is a well-coordinated effort to clean up the property. On private lands, it's up to the landowner or occupant. And that's where county code enforcement comes into play to assist with that.
Finally, just ending on this note, Jeremy, if someone sees an illegal grow on public lands, what should they do?
So I just want to reiterate, it is extremely rare for park visitors to stumble across these grow sites. They're not normally found near trails or campgrounds or day use areas. But for those folks who do venture off trail and may encounter signs of a cannabis grow site, obviously we want them to back out, not make any contact with the potential growers, and report the grow site to us. So if that's in a state park, we have a email tip line that can be accessed. It's watershed@parks.ca.gov. Folks can also contact our communication center, State Parks Dispatch, at 916-358-1300.
Well, I just want to thank all three of you for joining us. And
I'd like to also add that folks can also call CDFW's CalTIP number at 1-888-334-2258 as well. So if they want to report it to multiple sources, there's another number.
Well, thank you, Janice, Catherine, and Jeremy.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you.
Catherine Caldwell and Jeremy Stinson are with the California State Parks Cannabis Watershed Protection Program, and Janice Mackey is with California Fish and Wildlife, and they're discussing cannabis cultivation enforcement. Still ahead, we'll meet a Sacramento athlete who is the top breakdancer in the country and now training for the 2024 Summer Olympics. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The 2020 Summer Olympics just wrapped up a few weeks ago in Tokyo, of course postponed a year due to the pandemic, and we're just 3 short years away from the 2024 Olympics in Paris. You may have noticed a few new sports in the Summer Olympics: skateboarding, karate, sport climbing, and surfing. A few sports also made some new tweaks, like men's and women's 3-on-3 basketball and BMX freestyle. Well, the 2020 Olympic Committee decided to add breaking. Breaking made its Olympic debut in 2018 at the Youth Olympic Games in Buenos Aires and was selected for the 2024 Games because of its success. Here in Sacramento and Northern California, we have a wealth of Olympic athletes, and Morris Isby, who goes by the name B-Boy Morris, is training to represent Sacramento and the United States in the 2024 Olympics in breaking. B-Boy Morris joins us now. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Vicki. I appreciate being here.
Well, let's just start by describing to our listeners exactly what breaking or breakdancing is, and also how you learned how to do it.
So most people would say breaking started in 1984, but it actually started around 1973. Just everything was getting cultivated and brought together. It started in New York, and of course, you know, once it hit the 80s and everything, it went like mainstream across the United States. And it kind of died out in the early 90s, maybe towards like late 80s. And then the competition scene just took off. It just kept going. And for me, there was a VHS tape at the time called Ballet Year 98. It was one of the most well-known competitions in breaking in Germany. And there was a local crew called Rock Force. And it was the only thing while I was in high school that really could get me to focus. And I just saw, you know, teenagers who are around my age traveling the world. And it was something that I wanted to do, so I focused on it. But breaking, honestly, like, I guess the best way to personify that or kind of verbalize it would be is the official interpretation of hip hop music all the way back from the 80s.
You know, going back to that moment in high school, was that the moment when you realized that you could make a career out of breaking?
At that point, honestly, I was just doing it to travel. Do something fun, to travel, to meet girls. You know, I'm in high school. I was like 15 when I started. So like once I started seeing all the competitions like pop up everywhere and there were different levels to people's skill set, then I knew there was an opportunity for me to travel. It still took me about 5 years before I actually got out of the country.
How big of a moment was it when the Olympics announced breaking would be added to the Summer Olympics in 2024?
It was huge. The first step, actually, like you had said, was the Youth Olympics. And I was super excited for the youth to get the opportunity. As a B-boy, I've been breaking probably 23, going to be 24 years. So like I'm a little bit of the older generation in breaking now. But when it got announced for the adults, I was like, hey, this is going to be definitely something I'm going to go for as Flowers, you know, and to represent Sacramento. So it made us feel super excited. And honestly, with the amount of skill level and dedication that we bring, we want people to understand what we're doing so we can kind of, you know, share it more with the world.
Given how long you've been doing breaking, I mean, more than 20 years now, and you're from Sacramento, was there originally like a really good breaking scene here?
Oh, Sacramento, honestly, just all across dance is huge. Like one of the other well-known crews from Sacramento is Jabba Walkies. A lot of people don't know that right. They're from here. So like, but yeah, Sacramento has had many like breakdancing or b-boy champions come out of the city. I'm just like, you know, from the 2000s till now, I'm just one of the more consistent ones. And the other ones, they're still around too. They just live in different cities. I just never moved. I love Sacramento.
Yeah, as you're training and preparing for 2024, you already have some competitions lined up this year. In November, you're competing in Poland. So, I mean, just talk to us about that opportunity.
Most definitely. Poland, it will be the second time I've been there. It's going to be an amazing feel, especially, you know, in the situation that we are in the United States and all over the world with the pandemic. So that's definitely going to change a little things. And then, like I said, with my age, changing training regimens, eating and diet, everything matters now that we're officially considered athletes. And personally, I just want to do my best and try to get more of the city involved and, you know, kind of bring up a new younger community.
What is training like for breaking? I'm always interested in how athletes and Olympic athletes train for their sport.
Vicky, I'm still learning as we go. but for breaking, it's a little bit of everything. You have to practice rhythm. You have to practice weight training, cardio, because it's so many different aspects of physicalities that you have to have like all at the same time. But the biggest thing is just learning how to translate the music. So we're still creating new movements and new foundations. We have a foundation in our dance. But and I would say with any dance, what you want to do first is kind of learn the vocabulary of it. Like every dance should have like a foundation of the basic moves. And you just train religiously over and over and over on those until you master them. And then you start creating your own movements.
You know, what I also love is that you also volunteer and mentor. So how are you turning breaking into a way to actually help those younger than you?
Because honestly, I know when I was in high school, like I said, it helped me focus. And like I said, I'm a Luther Burbank Titan. So there were good kids there and there were bad kids there. But one of the biggest things that helped me out during that time was just everybody knew me for being under the stairs or doing rallies for dancing. So like all my focus was on schoolwork and just that. And with the kids now that I'm mentoring, it's just making sure that they know that there's a career in this. And at the very least, you can be a little bit more cultured by traveling the world. I've noticed the people who travel abroad a little bit more, they view the world differently and we end up working together better, you know, in all communities, all workforces. So it really helps the youth. I've already seen it take effect.
Well, that's awesome. Well, finally, before we let you go, where can people see you? How can they stay connected with you?
Okay, so like, of course, follow me on my Instagram, which is bboymorris_. But if you're here in Sacramento, I'm normally training at a place called Dynasty Athletes on Mondays and Wednesdays. You can look them up online, Dynasty Athletes. I believe it's off of Power In. But the studio I am officially with is called The Great House of Dance. It's on 1020 Front Street in Old Sacramento. You can't miss it. We're like the loudest place there. But we're there normally Fridays, but they have all sorts of dance classes for all ages. And let me just throw out there, I'm 37 years old. One of the oldest dancers I had in my workshops was, I believe, 73 at one point. So, like, at any time you guys want to come in and learn, come on down and let's have a talk and we'll get you dancing.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, B-Boy Morris, thank you so much. And just good luck on your journey to the 2024 Olympics.
Oh, thank you so much, Vicky, and I appreciate you having me.
Well, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minada. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.